witchcraft isn't safe, and nor should it be.
Imagine yourself under a starry sky, around the warm glow of a sacred fire, where speakers gather to share their wisdom and insights. Creating a sacred space where all are welcome to warm their hands, here are your hosts, Caitlin Stormbreaker, Sarinth Odinson, and Jim Two Sneaks, discuss spirituality, mythology, animism, and culture around a virtual sacred fire.
Welcome.
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 Welcome. Won't you join us around Grandfather Fire?
Spring by Lynette Roberts. Spring rules the world with open wing and leaves that sing and vibrate the air with birds so rare that man should fling his stress of being aside to bear the greater joy of the king of spring. As from a lawn the ringdove flies with soft silk sighs, greets Capricorn, her breast the dawn with ruby eyes stirs sound. Arise, sun's May day born, while woodlarks charm the petaled skies. When streams seep out of hidden stone and bee-like drone and celandine with crystal shine and undertone of yellow zone so well combined to serve spring's equinox well known. Then through the hedge with outgrown pace, he trails green traces on horns of light, the farm bull white of sacred race with blindweed lace and aconite, recalls a rite of age-long grace, disturbs the trout's rock-pooled display as roundlet of gorslet birds, as gay as words, they fly with May and stir the day's white-blossomed curds. Then out to fields their nests survey. You these observe. Then migrants come with wing-beat drumming geese, cuckoo, warblers too, swifts, scissored hum, the frolicsome dogs, sheep in you, see round this valley, strife is dumb, for in this alley, Artemis walks, with sparrow, hawks, and wing-like dove, she fills the grove with rain that talks, and greens the stalks of birch above. Attend these leaves, the queen of spring. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Around Grandfather Fire. You're listening to episode number 109. I'm Jim Two Snakes, joined as always by my good friends and co-hosts, Sarah Thodenson and Caitlin Stormbreaker. How's everybody doing tonight?
That was a beautiful poem, Jim, but the only thing that really stuck out to me was strife is dumb, and I agree.
Strife is dumb. Yep.
But I'm doing
well. Faced with all this beauty, just strife, just shut the hell up. Our world's got plenty of you. Shut up already.
You know what? You had all of winter to have your time. It is my turn now. Spring is here. There's blooms. My lilacs are fucking growing.
Right.
Strife is dumb.
Shut up and sit down, strife. We've had enough.
Yeah. Speaking of spring, allergies are in the air. We've got a windstorm rolling through here, so if you hear any weirdness behind me, it's not ghosts, mostly the wind trying to blow our siding.
By and large, it's not ghosts.
Yeah, well, I mean, the ghosts really only get that active when I'm in the shower or in my bedroom getting ready for night. Then they're out and walking around or playing the phantom radio that I still can't find. It's the weirdest
when you're in the
thing.
Shower, you got Casper the perverted ghost running around your house. What are we going on here?
Well, he's not in the shower with me as far as I know. But I do hear him walking around out there and I'm like, all right, buddy, just don't steal our shit, okay? Yeah, I'm waiting for the ibuprofen to kick in. Currently fighting off a migraine between the pollen, early pollen, I guess, that's rolling around in the storm that's raging on outside. So, yeah.
wouldn't be springtime without transitioning from sun to snow within about 10 minutes.
That's fair. I am a little pissed, though, because for my whole life up until I hit about 26 or 27, I didn't have allergies.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, my body
does happen.
Decided.
Itch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't like pollen. Anyway, how are you guys?
Not doing too bad. How about you, Saren?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Well, I got woke up at 12:50, 12:45, somewhere in there, after a couple hours of sleep after work. I thought somebody was calling my fucking name. Looked around. Not the kids. Not my partners. Nope. Turns out the ancestors wanted fucking coffee. So.
Well, that was nice of them to wake you up like that.
Motherfuckers. So. I inherited a pour-over coffee system from my father-in-law, who has recently passed. My mother-in-law doesn't drink coffee. She's like, here, are you going to use this? I'm like, sure, I've never used a pour-over. Why not? Okay, I get the appeal now. I get it. Because holy shit, that is the best coffee I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't able to drink the coffee until I had served all the house's ancestors, the Tomta, the Desir Saith Kona, which is, oh, I'm sorry, back here, those of you who have video access will be able to see them. There's a gentleman with a hat and a beard. That's the Tomta. This is our Desir Saith Kona. And they have been thick as thieves ever since we brought her home from Khan. The Desir Saith Kona, is reminiscent of the German shaman figure they found. And she's about 6,000 years old. And that's what she's based after. She's got rabbit skin. Anyway, so these old folks all wanted their coffee first. I had to serve my father-in-law the coffee first because
45 minutes later, you get to have some coffee.
No, more like half an hour because I had to boil a new pot of coffee. But I really dig the pour-over system. It doesn't have any of that sharpness that your usual brews do.
Mm-hmm. No, it's nice and rich and creamy almost. And yeah, you don't really need to add anything to it. Yeah, I refuse to buy one. I already do a French press every morning. I don't want to do poured over as well.
I'm fucking ruined now.
Yeah.
I'm ruined because I've never had coffee like that. So that's but like between that and we weren't sure if the windstorm was going to knock out the power. So in order to make sure we had gas for the generators, we went and put gas in the gas cans, put gas in the car, ran the water just in case, you know, when this windstorm knocks out our power, because it's kind of like rolling the dice with these windstorms anymore.
Yeah. The last two at the very least knocked out power in our area. I know the ice storm did for sure.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Like the entire lower southeast Michigan area, like 400,000 people or some people like that.
Right. Yeah. It was crazy.
So it was nuts. Mm-hmm. So that's what's been on my mind is like getting woken up by the ancestors, making coffee and prepping just in case the power goes out. How about you, Jim?
I'm doing pretty good. It's been a fairly quiet week. Let me, for those of you who do have the video access, months ago, I had ordered something from the Ukraine and it took forever to arrive because they literally lost it in tracking. Like, you know, hey, there's a fucking war. What do I expect? Right. But also, what do I expect? Of course, this is going to show up. So I got this wonderful hand carved icon of Eris.
Nice. Oh, wow.
I love it.
Isn't that cool? Got the little apple down there and the symbol. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So
who is the artist? Like, that's amazing.
I couldn't tell you without looking it up. I got it on Etsy, though. So,
show notes.
Yeah. Right. And I will do that. But yeah. So, other than that, though, things have been pretty quiet, pretty good. Can't complain too much.
Actually want to give like a real quick shout out because I know we talked about it before the show. And I told you guys, I feel like this migraine is payment for chapter 7 for the novel. But I do want to say thank you, and I won't name names so you guys can remain anonymous, but I want to thank my alpha readers that have been giving me very good feedback and like encouraging me to keep going. And I'm just so, so grateful for the support you guys have been showing me. And I love you. Thank you very much.
Well, thinking of thank yous too, I also want to throw out there before I'll probably have Sarinth introduce our guests again since time, but, returning Patreons, Emily and Alyssa, they've signed back up for Patreon. So we appreciate that support. Our Patreon's been doing really well. And I know we all appreciate your support because we've used it for various upgrades on things here and there and paying for the Zoom subscription and all the other fun stuff that we need for this show. So we do appreciate your support. But if you can't financially support us, as always, go out and leave us a nice review, share the show, you know, post the link up somewhere. It all adds up, but we do really appreciate all of our Patreons and all of your support. So with that, Sarah, do you want to introduce tonight's guest?
Yes, absolutely. So I would like everybody to welcome to the show Kat Heath, also known online as CO Hellrin. She has been a heathen for quite the while and is the founder of the Cult of the Spinning Goddess and co-founder of the Open Halls Project, holding membership in the Shenandoah Valley-based Great Valley Kindred, as well as the Troth. She has led ritual and taught classes, both locally at in-person events, online, and as a co-presenter of the 2018 Land, Sea, Sky Travel Hidden Folk, which is an Elves Tour of Iceland. She hails from Lancashire, England, and has come to call Maryland home after a decade and a half of magical and mundane adventures across three continents. Her home on the web is cohellrune.com. If anybody is looking for somebody who is an excellent teacher on how to work with the other crowd, and my experience with her mound workshops was just amazing. Peerless. I wish that I'd run across you well before. I also own your book, Elves, Witches, and Gods. And honestly, like both of these resources I wish I'd had when I first started my journey in Sather. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the nice words as well. I don't really know what to say about that.
So how about we started the how did you get into everything that you're now teaching and putting out in your books?
Oh, good grief. How far do you want to go back?
Wherever you're comfortable starting.
I think it all really began when I was a kid. I grew up with, you know, my dad, he came from a family of spiritualists. And when I mean spiritualists, I mean like the OG Victorian era spiritualists, like basically necromancy with optional Jesus. And that was his family. That's what he grew up with. And I kind of grew up with that as well. My mom wasn't really into it, but my dad, he used to teach me to manipulate energy. He would get taken over by a spirit guide. His face would change. His voice would change. So I was very used to having strange things happen. And then when I was 11, 10 or 11, we had silent reading at school. And this was like 1991, 1992, maybe. And I picked up a book of Norse mythology. And I don't know what the heck it was about this book of Norse mythology that after I read a few stories, I went home and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go pray to Odin, as you do. So that's kind of where that started. And that went on for a little bit until this kid came to school and was like, I got confirmed. I can drink wine now underage. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go do that too. But that didn't really last very long. I think I was like a nominal Christian for like 4 months. I was like, screw that, I'm going back to what I was doing before. Unfortunately, spiritualism, in my experience, didn't really have good tools for making someone feel safe when they're experiencing a lot as a young person. So I started to get into witchcraft because it's like, oh, tools. And our local library had like 4 books. You could only get 3 out because if you got the 4th book out, the librarians would actually call your parents to let them know that you were looking at Janet Farrar's naked body. So that was a thing. Yeah, you know which one I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. The Witch's Bible. So that really wasn't a book you could get out. And I just kind of took it to the local moors, really. I was just experiencing things, trying to sort of like figure out, okay, how do I make friendships? How do I find relationships with these different beings and these different places that I'm sensing in these, like, these wild areas? And so I kind of gained this very experimental attitude from an early start. And it also helped that I didn't really have access to the internet until I was 17. You know, where I lived, we didn't have the infrastructure in my hometown until 1999. And in 1997, 1998, I only got the access to the internet because I got on a bus for 45 minutes to like a junior college, and that's where the internet was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really kind of, you know, so I was just sort of in this middle of nowhere kind of place, like really backwards place. You know, just to let you know how backwards it was, they got their first coffee shop in 2005. That was really forward thinking for them. So it's a kind of place where a lot of older lore survives, you know, and people just have a very casual attitude to strange things. People used to come up to me and be like, "Your dad did that thing where he healed me again," just in the street. You know, it's just, all right.
All right.
Okay, cool. I'm glad you're feeling better. So,
I mean, at least you have that with your dad. People know my dad is a tall car guy. They're like, "Oh, hey, you're that guy's daughter." And I'm like, "Sure am."
I mean, like, there's nothing wrong with being the tall car guy's daughter. You know, there's like pros and cons to each, really, isn't there?
That's true.
Yeah. Like, none of this is better or worse than the other. So I started traveling. I lived in a tent in France for a while. I lived in Spain and Portugal. I got a degree somehow along the way. I moved to South Korea. But before I moved to South Korea, that's when I started to get the idea to, you know, hey, look at this thing in this text, in this like historic text, this form of magic. I wonder what would happen if I tried that out myself. So 2005, I crawled inside my first burial mound at night and figured out what the hell I was going to do. I had a couple of friends with me. I actually blogged about it on my blog. It was an absolute disaster. A lot of people had a lot to say about it on my blog post, which is called "Witchcraft Isn't Safe and Nor Should It Be." And people had opinions. People really had opinions, always like, "Oh, you should have done this. You should have done that. You should have done that." And I'm just like, all right, yeah, because like mound spirits totally come with like, you know, monster manual, like stat blocks, like, and so you can figure out what you've got to compare with them.
You know, there's definitely a post right next to him with a guidebook hanging off of it and how to deal with this kind
absolutely.
Of shit, right?
And what's really ironic is before we actually spent the night in that burial mound, my friends who live more locally, they actually went a couple of times beforehand to sort of feel out the place. And they didn't feel anything like what we encountered that night, because that place is, you either get the Wayland vibe, which is very chill and Hail, like, which is an old English word meaning whole, sound, holy, healthy, or you get the really horrible asshole dude in there who, you know, since running my mound magic course, I actually got an email from one of the participants who had encountered the same guy in that mound as me. And she was like, "Oh my God, I know exactly who you're on about with that guy." I'm like, right, yeah. Right? Horrible. She had to get help to get purification stuff done when she came back, because it actually made her sick. She was sick from the encounter. Yeah.
Did he decide to come along as a ride along?
I don't know. I think what he did was more like he sort of depleted her a little bit, which kind of left her a bit,
sure,
you know, open to issues. So yeah, that was, I mean, of course I can't diagnose that because I didn't see her at the time. But that would be my guess. He seems pretty stuck in place. Oh, no, he did follow us down that tall path. Maybe. Yeah, we did have to stop him from following us further. So she didn't, and she did come, but she did come back to the States. So I don't think he would have followed over here unless she brought something from his mound. So I don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense. I ask because occasionally I live a walk from a local graveyard, and Occasionally, some of the dead will kind of wander back with you if you're not really keen. At least in the area, I know that one of the things we do is we give offerings to the gate guardians, entry and leaving.
Knocking on the posts.
Sometimes it's pennies, sometimes it's tobacco. That's kind of like a measure of, okay, look, we're showing our due respect. We're showing our honor. So that, I think it's interesting how some of the dead seem to be more mobile than some of the others.
It's funny. It just occurs to me, you know, like, yes, that's scary. Air quotes, scary. But I mean, like, Sarah, you, me, Caitlin, we've all had people like follow us around in the grocery store telling us their problems too. So this is not something that's
you're not wrong. Just
beast, you know?
All I mean, it just depends on the story that they're trying to tell you. I mean, if you stop me and tell me that I look a lot like your granddaughter and that you just happen to wear the hat that she gave you before she died kind of thing, that's very sweet and kind. But if you're telling me that you murdered a bunch of people and...
Have you had this happen, Caitlin? This is what I'm...
Well, no, I mean, there's varying degrees of storytelling. Like, some things need to stay inside.
Yeah.
I love that, though, Kat. I love how just, like, taking the adventure of, like, wonder what would happen. Let's find out.
I mean, to be fair, I do think a lot of that was, like, uncontrolled ADHD. So, like, my risk and assessment was not exactly great.
I got nothing. I can't say shit.
But I just kind of carried on. You know, like, oh, let's give this a go. And, you know, I'll just get these ideas and I'll just go for it. I'll just create an experiment and then I'll try it out. And then I'll try roping other people in once I don't die. And, you know, kind of go from there and just tweak it until I get better and better results. So
through all of that curiosity, experimentation, and execution along the way, I'm assuming you picked up varying degrees of tools and processes to kind of help smooth out the inception of the task ahead.
There are definitely some basics I keep up with all the time. Like, purification is a huge thing for me. I also practice some form of magic pretty much every day. Usually that is, I mean, my kid, she's 9. She experiences stuff like I did when I was a kid, but she's at that phase where she's really scared still, and she's not going to get past that phase unless she gets a feeling of safety. So even though she doesn't really need wards doing in a room every night and like walking through shielding every night, I'm going to do it with her because, you know, it's more important to me that she feels safe. Plus, it's me just doing stuff. You know, it's keeping me doing stuff. And it's also teaching her. You know, so eventually she'll be able to do it herself. So it's kind of like killing 3 birds with 1 stone.
Bonnie, go ahead, Sarah. I was just going to say that you're building a repetitive practice with her to where if she does experience something and you're not around to help her kind of quell it, she can call on that and be like, okay, this is what I need to do. And that's really cool that I love magical parents.
I wish I'd had that when I was a kid, really. You know, what I do with my kid, I wish that my dad had had that knowledge because, I mean, spiritualism, when I was going through a lot of stuff as a teen and seeing a lot of different things that were scaring me. I mean, I still see things now, but they don't bother me really anymore. You know, I'm either too desensitized from all the fuckery I've gotten up to over the years, or I mean, I don't know. Like, I've just kind of come to a point where I'm just like, oh, they're doing that. Okay, cool. You do you, friend. Like spiritualism, when I was going through all that lot, my dad, he didn't really know what to do because he's always been more of a healer and never really like had the clairvoyance going on. And so he's always sort of sensed them. But when anything's going down, his spirit guide takes over and then he just kind of, you know, he just goes into autopilot then. And he wasn't entirely sure how to help me seeing and hearing them and feeling them. That was his mom. His mom had that. he didn't know what to do. And so he went to like a friend of his locally, and this friend was like, oh, your daughter needs to raise her vibration. You know, it's her vibration's low and attracting these low beings, and she needs to raise the vibration. I'm just like, what the fuck is a vibration? I have no clue what you're talking about, dude. But it was also really victim-blaming.
Built you a treehouse and said, go up there, raise your vibration.
But it was like, I don't know what to do. And right. I kind of feel like I'm being blamed for it, because it's like a thing personal to me, which as a 13, 14-year-old is not great. It's really not great. So I just wish that, you know, I could have had that as a kid, you know, so.
Oh, yeah, because I mean, like a teenager, you're a vulnerable age anyway, mm-hmm. to be told, well, your vibration's too low. That could be.
That's
what do you
shitty.
Mean?
It's one of those points where like you have like, I think psychism kind of goes in ebbs and flows. You know, like you have this point when you're like 7, 8, 9, where it's like all kind of kicking off, that you remember more because you're not young seeing it. And then around about 13, 14, you get it again. And then like in your late teens, you get it again. And it was happening in that kind of 13, 14-year-old block. So you've not only got all the emotional teen stuff, like what you were just talking about, Jim, you've also got this sort of like acceleration of experiences happening too. And you're just like, I don't know what the hell to do. And the first time I saw, you know, casting a circle in a book, I was like, hell yeah, I'm going to give that a go. Hopefully it keeps this shit from pestering me all the time. So I was like, all right, I guess I'm becoming a witch now.
So it makes total sense that, you know, when people in your community don't know what the hell to tell you, you're going to reach for your own damn tools and figure out your own damn self.
Yeah. Yeah. And now it's got to a point where, I mean, I was just back visiting my family in December, and pretty much within an hour of getting to my parents' house, my dad was like, so I think one of the dead dogs is haunting our bedroom. Can you go up and tell us which one it is? I was like, all right.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, they've had a couple of dogs die like since I last lived there. I last lived there in 2007, so it's been a while. One was an older dog that they rescued, and the other one was again an older dog. They've always kind of gotten rescue dogs. And they had two dogs who it could have potentially been that was bouncing around on their bed at night. And so my dad wanted to know which of the dogs was bouncing on the bed at night so he could be like, lay down and say the name. Yeah, like, and it turned out, I went into the bedroom and I saw this, like, this speckled cow-looking dog. I don't know what these dogs are called. But I saw this dog kind of, like, jump across the bed at me. And I went downstairs and I was like, it's your cow dog. I don't know what they're called. And he's like, oh, Jesse. All right, yeah, I'll tell Jesse to lie down the next time she starts. I was like, all right, okay, cool.
I find that really fascinating because in our communities, somebody would tell you just whip out your tarot deck or your runes and figure out which fucking dog it is. And I think it's really interesting that because of your background, I know Jim and Caitlin can probably attest to this in their own experiences, the tool of divination of figuring shit out is just a necessary part of the gig of figuring out and working with spirits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find that utterly fascinating that a spiritualist has no tools unless they have direct experience of the spirits like that.
That's a huge thing.
That's fucking weird to me. I'm sorry.
No, well, I mean, is it when you say spiritualism, is this the same sort of spiritualism that was so popular or still is popular in some areas of Florida, that sort of thing, like the started way back when with the sisters and the. Yeah, yeah, so I mean, they literally don't have those kind of tools, Sarah. They all depend on their spirit guides to do all that for them.
It's literally spirit contact. That's like literally the only dogma that, you know, the afterlife. Yeah. Exist, you can communicate with them. And this is what I mean when it's like necromancy with optional Jesus. Yeah. You know, a lot of them do get into tarot cards and other stuff. But for example, my dad was always taught not to touch tarot cards. His mom and Ouija boards as well. I didn't used to be able to use Ouija boards for years because my ancestors would show up and shut that shit down. You know, I'd be on ghost hunts and people be doing a Ouija board. And as soon as the spirits are asked to talk to me, which whatever, talk to me, I guess, it would just shut down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, yeah, it's, they hate totally Ouija boards. That.
Yeah, some of the reports, some of the stuff I've read or and listened to, it's like there are some of them that use tarot cards, but they almost use them as props because mm-hmm. it's just like for a lot of them, it's if someone comes to them for a reading, they know that it's their spirit guide speaking through them.
Mm-hmm.
But the person getting read almost needs a prop of something to look at.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's it's really wild. It is a different, totally different paradigm than the witch or heathen paradigm.
And they really like privilege being spirit taught over any kind of knowledge.
Yes.
So, and for me, the pure spirit taught model throws up so many red flags because of what I grew up with. You know, it's, I've seen what happens when it's uncritical, you know, when it's not balanced out. So, I mean, for me, it's always got to be a balance, you know, it, for me, research, scholarship goes hand in hand with gnosis. You know, I can't separate the two. It's always kind of interacting with each other for me. Mm-hmm. But for my dad, you know, he's had people compliment his skills because he is purely spirit taught, you know, and that's that again, it's a very different way of doing things. So
I've run across Kardec style spiritualism before because I've been to a Misa or two, actually several.
Well, they're different again, the Kardec, and those, Kardec people.
Very, very different, which is why I was like, wow. Because again, the Spiritismo services are totally fucking different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh,
the there were protections laid down, there were prayers made. Holy shit. Yeah. So damn. Like that's just, it kind of is blowing my mind because the spiritualism I've encountered has safeguards built into the ritual. So that's just,
yeah, if anyone's interested, I know I would recommend personally the, if you want to know more about American spiritualism and the Fox sisters and that sort of stuff, there's a podcast. It was a limited run podcast. I think there's 5 or 6 episodes, Ghost Church by Jamie Loftus. Mm-hmm. And that covers the history of American spiritualism and how it is now. And she does cover a little bit how it separated itself, how English and American spiritualism are different at this point in time. But she kind of covers a little bit about how that happened. And it's really a fascinating listen.
Yeah. And like one of the big differences from what I understand, you know, I'm friends with a pagan who grew up spiritualist over here, and her mom is a spiritualist clergy member, and they're very much like organized churches and like camps and stuff, whereas where I grew up it was in family practice, you know, it was mostly kept as a family practice. And I used to think it was just my family that did that, but then I had a coworker when I was like 18, and she just happened to mention, oh man, I'm tired. And I was like, oh, were you at partying? And she's like, no, I was up talking to the dead last night. I was like, oh, cool. Like, you know, why? And she's like, oh, well, we're spiritualists. I'm like, really? Your family too? She's like, yeah, we just really do stuff about family. And it's like, ah. And it seems to have been like a family thing. And it was in England, from what I understand from Jack Hunter, he's got a PhD. He's done a lot of research in spiritualism. He's, from what I understand from him, it really kind of took root in the sort of working class areas of Northern England, which is, hey, my background. And, you know, it was very much like this. It went from like churches and gatherings to this like family practice. And now because of the internet, you're starting to get these different family groups and sort of slightly larger groups sort of getting together again and sharing tech. And, you know, it's really fascinating. And this is a total aside, but the kind of seances where they have a specific chair and they use music, like people will sing hymns usually mm-hmm. to call the dead and energize the dead. And then the person in the seat, like the seer, so to speak, the medium, it parallels the seer account in Erik Sagadalda. So that always, that's always interesting to me. Just like, all right. Never my family did anything that cool, but like...
No, but I mean, that kind of direct experience of the thing that I love it. I grew up Catholic. So a lot of the gifts of the spirit kind of a thing, we were a much more mystic friendly household and a much more mystic friendly church. So like having visions and experiences and all this stuff was fine and dandy as long as it comported with church teachings. But I grew up with folks who are like, no, if you've got people talking to you, there's a problem. You need to go see your pastor immediately. So I find all these different stories as we collect them on this podcast really fascinating, and setting them off against my own experiences, because, you know, talking to saints and having angels talk with you wasn't unusual, but it's a different thing than what you're talking about. And it's also a different thing than what, you know, Pentecostal classmates would talk about. Like being slain in the spirit is a whole different experience.
Oh, that's so weird. That's so weird. I mean, I shouldn't say that because that's judging their practices. But like, whenever I see it, it's like, are they having a Jesus orgasm? Like, what is this?
Kind of.
I don't know.
I mean, it's weird for us. But if you're growing up in that environment, it's almost like, well, this is one of the elect. Yeah.
That's just Sunday afternoon. It's funny you mentioned Catholicism. You know, like Catholicism has a lot of tolerance for like folk Catholic practices, and you know, people will say prayers to recover lost goods and stuff. And you know, I have a friend who's a Sicilian witch, and they will threaten Saint Anthony with using his statue to clean the toilet if he doesn't come through.
Sorry.
The people I used to work with are deeply Catholic, and the son has told me some interesting stories about interactions he's had with certain saints of like, hey, bring me my thing or I'm going to do this kind of thing. And I'm like, what? There's you threaten your saints?
Okay. There's that like Mediterranean, like a PGM derived, like, you know, I'm going to smack talk you if you don't come through, you know?
Yeah.
Because you find that in the Greco-Egyptian magical papyri, you know, like in these rituals, there's often this kind of, if you don't do this, I'm going to tell everyone you suck kind of thing.
Yeah. And
usually your protection in, like, you have to wear a phylactery to protect you from the spirit or deity that you are petitioning, because, you know, you're also being an asshole to spirit or deity.
Yeah. Tons of that in Italian folk magic too, the pre-Christian folk magic. It's the same thing. It's like,
for us,
I'll take your whole damn grove down. I'll take your statue down. I'll bury it under the chamber pot. I mean, like, we're...
Don't make me go clean the toilet with you, St. Anthony. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I've heard of burying him. That's a new one on me. Oh, my God.
I think it's St. Anthony. It's one of them. I didn't grow up Catholic. You know, like, I grew up very nominally Church of England, cake or death, and spiritualist. You know, the Church of England cake or death was what you put on this, on your forms. People aren't really that religious there. yeah, it's, and it's funny because Lancashire was traditionally a Catholic place, and it was associated with witches, and a lot of the witchcraft was a lot of folk Catholicism, and a lot of the charms are very similar to the early English charms that you find in the Lacnunga and the way that they function. You know, there's an old charm for collecting valerian, which is vervain, for collecting vervain, which is like the main protective herb there. And this charm is basically giving you bits of historioli, you know, like the sort of like story bits of a charm, and talking about the herb and what the herb did at this point as a person. So we're acknowledging the personhood of a plant person. And, you know, it's like this charm you say while you're collecting vervain for sacred purposes and healing. And people are still using that in, I think that was recorded in the 19th century, that charm. So, you know, people have always kind of been a little bit wild there. It's just always, so I'm not surprised that spiritualism took off. You know, oh, we get to do weird things and not be classed as like, you know, getting into trouble with the law. We're in.
Let's do this.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny you mention about Catholicism as well, the tolerance for visions and whatnot. Because a few years ago, I used to go to a lot of these sort of Civil War battlefields near where I live to see if any of the dead wanted help moving on. Because it didn't seem like a good idea that all these dead were kind of knocking around, just still influencing people and, you know, just being unhappy. And we were at, I think it's Fredericksburg. Yeah. And we came across some of the Irish regiment people. And there's this very strong, like, last rites. And I'm like, oh, hell, I can't help you with that. I've never been a Catholic. I'm not even a Christian. How's about I say a prayer to breach to you, for you, right? But I don't know if it's going to be the saint or not. Let me try and do you something. You know, here's some rum or whiskey. Here's, like, you know, do you want a drinking song? I can do that. And I end up emailing the priest of the local Catholic church. And I'm like, hey, yeah, so it's a really weird story. I was on the battlefield the other day and I told him what had happened with the dead. And he was like, so just to be clear, was this like you had a vision or like a in your mind conversation? I was like, yeah, something like that. But they seem really bothered by the whole dying without last rites. I don't know what you can do for that. And if, you know, I can try and raise money to get whatever done for them. Because I felt bad for these guys, you know? And this priest was like, you know, it's funny you mention it. I was walking along there with whatever they call, like, the trainee priests. I don't know what they call them.
Oh, maybe like one of the deacons, perhaps?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't speak Catholicism.
Or novitiate, probably.
Maybe. Okay. I don't speak Catholicism. So he's like, I was walking along there with my dude and I was, you know, we were talking about the dead and we were talking about, were they really like, you know, at peace and everything? Because people keep having like weird vibes here. And he's like, so I take this as a sign from Providence that I should say a mass for the dead and I'll do it for free because I have that sign as well. And I was like, oh man, thank you. That's awesome. So that was really neat of him. That was really like very tolerant, you know.
That's awesome.
That is right? Really cool.
What a nice guy. I thought it was just, yeah.
I do think it's kind of cute that he and his dude were walking by and he got the ping to do something for them. But then it took you also confirming it for him that this was something that needed to be done. And it's a neat, I guess, crossover between the two different faiths that, you know, we need confirmation on some of our messages, but so do they also, most of them for that matter. But
this priest needs a confirmation. Let's try the fucking pagans.
I mean, they didn't listen to it before, but
I was expecting to get a lot of like fire and brimstone back. But
right.
I was just like, you know, I've got this dead guy from Fredericksburg knocking around my house. I need to like, you know, do this because he's not happy and they weren't happy either. So I got followed home that time as well. So, all right, cool. Dead guy from Fredericksburg. All right. But then the priest was totally cool about it. And that was awesome.
That is so fucking cool.
I have experienced far more tolerance from Catholics than I have from Christians in my day, both back when I was atheist and well into my pagandom, I guess.
You mean like the sort of like Lutherans, Protestants, like that kind of?
Yeah, the umbrella Christian. Yeah, the umbrella Christians, I guess. I don't typically ask like what brand of Christian are you, because I don't know the difference anyway. So.
What variety are you? What flavor?
Yes, what ice cream flavor of Christianity are you?
And like someone like the only true kind.
And what does that mean?
Vanilla, understood.
Yeah, the kind I avoid. Wicked.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I don't know. I think like you've been around for like 1500 years. You've probably like your church has probably seen a lot of weird shit. Kind of gotten used to dealing with it.
Yeah. After a while, I think you just kind of go, okay. Yeah. Sure. That's another one to add to the list. Right. Cool.
Right, for real. It's definitely. Yeah. Anyway.
One of the things I want to touch on a little bit more is one that we talked about before the show. And so I looked at your blog and there's a lot of stuff about filling in the plot holes and making mistakes in rituals. And we talked about how sometimes those mistakes are the most important thing mm-hmm. that can happen to us. Would you mind expanding on that a little and how you do that whole filling in the plot holes process and how you sort through some of the information?
Okay. So basically, I'm actually writing, I'm still writing at the blogs on this. So you're kind of like getting a spoiler of the next blog post really in this series. But yeah, with the plot holes, sometimes with the plot holes, it is, you know, first you have to realize there's a plot hole there potentially. And it's not always a plot hole that was there in the past. You know, sometimes you have to realize that your plot holes are things that, you know, your expectation of ritual, what is required for a functioning ritual. That's what the plot hole is. That's what you fill in. Okay. Because we don't really have a clue about, you know, in the more sort of like ceremonial communities, the PGM community, because they have a very experimental attitude as well, which is awesome. They talk about framing rituals, you know, so we don't know if they had that kind of thing. We don't know if they, like the heathen period people had that. We don't know if the heathen period people had, you know, similar sort of and like grounding, centering practices. There's no mention of any of that. But what we do have is sort of little bits of hints in the Laknunga and some of the other texts, like, you know, just kind of like letting you know that, okay, you just do the thing that we know what to do already. You know, there's no point, it's so basic, there's no point actually writing this down. We're just going to, you know, I'm just going to assume you know that. And if not, what are you doing healing people? That's the kind of vibe. So that's one of the ways that you know there's a plot hole. The other ways, you know, this is clearly missing things. The story doesn't make sense in my head. The story of this ritual, when you walk it through, doesn't make sense in my head. I can see that, you know, these bits aren't connected, you know. And then when it comes to filling them, when it comes to filling these plot holes, it's some of it's through research, you know, some of it's like, okay, are there similar practices in the same cultures, sources, you know? Are there other examples of this? Yes? Great. Let's look at them. Let's see what else we can get from them. No? Okay. Are there similar practices in related cultures or cultures that they had a lot of interaction with? You know? Yes? Okay, cool. Let's see what they understood from that. Because what I found is that different cultures tended to focus on different things, like writing different things down. You know, like the Norse were very big on writing down the stories, but they wrote hardly anything about their healing practices. In fact, I mean, what's he called now? Dubois. I think it's called Thomas Dubois. Nordic religions in the Viking Age or something. I'll have to get back to you with the show notes. So he actually wrote about how they would basically kidnap early English healers and then drag them off to, like, you know, back to like Iceland, wherever they were going, and like, hey, we got a healer now. So
Nordic religions in the Viking Age.
Yes. So they really kind of like wrote down different things. And the Irish, for example, they wrote down a lot about inspiration, as did the Welsh. And there's some parts, like there's some practices, like in my book, I talk about going under the cloak. One of the ways that I backfilled to create an experiment for going under the cloak was to look at the Irish and Welsh sources. And that's when it started to kind of occur to me that, okay, maybe this is connected to inspiration. Okay, what did they understand by inspiration? Okay, now what can I find in the Norse sources that kind of connects back to what I've just found in the Irish and Welsh sources? So that's another form of backfilling. Another form, there's some really weird little sort of similarities between what you find, the magic you find in the PGM, the Greco-Egyptian magical papyri, and also the Norse sources. Actually, Stephen Mitchell, he's a scholar of, he wrote Witchcraft and Magic in the Nordic Middle Ages, I think. He actually wrote a paper talking about the similarities between the necromancy in the Gesta Danorum and one of the necromantic rituals in the PGM. So sometimes you can kind of like, okay, this is just a general thing you find in a lot of magical traditions. So maybe we can kind of repurpose it here just to sort of fill in this plot hole. But then the final No. The second to final plot hole is things like, you know, when you work magic, you know what works. You know what you need to add to keep yourself safe. So I can't say that, you know, grounding, centering, shielding was a thing back in the Viking Age, but I know that it works for me now. And so I'm going to do it because it's smart. If you're going to go crawling into burial mounds and calling up the dead, you do all the smart things you can because you're already doing something stupid. So you might as well do everything else smart. And then the final plot hole is, you know, what's your gnosis saying? What are you getting, you know, from your instincts? What are you getting from also your previous experiences doing these kind of experiments? What kind of vibes are you getting from this? And so when people are doing this kind of work, I tell them to write everything down, you know, whether it's your research, whether it's your gnosis, and to be very clear where you got it from, you know, because it doesn't mean you put it aside by not labeling it research. You just kind of like, you just start labeling where the different threads are. And then when you're weaving it in later, you can show your working if people want to know. And then also, you know, you're not punking yourself and you're not disrespecting the allies you have by pretending that what they gave you came from a book or something like that. So those are the plot holes. That's the plot holes. Now you wanted to know about fuck ups.
Well, I want to point at something that you were talking about is writing everything down, whether it's research or gnosis or experiences mm-hmm. that don't necessarily line up with the research.
Yeah.
If you write all of that down, you begin to find trends and similarities mm-hmm. and yeah. uncover more and more pieces of the story. Yeah. And of what you're learning. And that's why it is very imperative. And if you're not a writer, speak it, record it into like a tape recorder or your phone or your yeah. computer or something. Just speak it and get it out so that you have this information at hand and then you can mm-hmm. use it going forward in your practice.
Absolutely. The notes app on my phone gets so much usage. It's just so useful. The notes app, the recorder app, you know, is if I've lost my phone, I'd be losing so much research. I need to actually get on transferring that nonsense. You know, all these different, same. All these different, like, you know, journeys, visions, interactions, you know, I recorded all. Notes apps are great. The search functions. Oh, wait, I've heard someone about that thing. Let's search for it. Oh, yeah, crap. Like 2 years ago, I got
Google Docs
this.
And Google Keep notes have saved my ass so many times.
Yeah.
Because it backs everything up to the cloud and I can print it.
I need to do that.
The biggest lie that you will tell yourself, especially coming out of a journey or a trance or an experience, is that, yeah, I'll remember later. You're simply just not going to remember it.
It starts to fade. Although I will say that the Yertvi Grid work I've been doing, the trance stuff in that is very, very visceral and it sticks around a lot more than if you're just kind of like doing a trance with a drum. It's wild. Just the level of detail you get and how quickly you get dropped into a deep state. It's awesome.
Yeah. We're looking at setting up our own Gotavi grid since taking your mound class. For those who don't know what a Gotavi grid is, can you explain what that is right quick?
Okay. So the Yertvi grid was found at a place in Sweden called Yertvi. It is an archaeological site that they found in a field. I don't remember what year. I think it was like 2008, maybe. And basically, it is this amazing... It's in the middle of the salt marsh. And it's kind of a de facto island, but it's very subtle. The island nature is very subtle. Archaeologists kind of figured out that it was an island because they're like, oh, wait, this is actually... Oh, crap, this is water here. Right, let's get back onto this thing. And so they'd created an artificial mound, and on the mound, they created this grid pattern. And you have this this square box, and it's all kind of dug into ground, and these shapes are sort of filled in with rock. So as you look at it from above, you're just like looking at this grid. You know, you can walk on it. You can walk on it. You're not like climbing over it. It's flat to the ground. So you have like a square, and then you have these nine sort of like shapes in all directions around it, and it's all in a rectangular shape. They also found evidence of, like, it had a northeast-southwest orientation, which is quite common in funerary archaeology. Whenever you find these sort of like doorposts and thresholds next to burial mounds, they're usually the southwest of a burial mound, which means that you're facing in the northeast to the mound, which the mound is the realm of the dead. And, you know, generally speaking, okay. Gylfaginning in the Prose Edda, it talks about hell being in the north, but like, you know, more general kind of like northerly kind of direction is what I take it to be. So, you know, when you have this kind of like southwest northeast orientation with sites, generally it's got a necromantic sort of vibe to it. So the Yertvi grid has this orientation. They also had a lot of posts. Now, I'm yet to find decent information about how these posts were sort of set up. I mean, maybe they don't know. You know, they're usually going off evidence of post holes. And just to further complicate matters, the grid itself would have been invisible back in the day because they covered it over with clay. So they wouldn't have known that it was under there. You know, it was just this awesome site, and there's evidence that they sacrificed blood and fat, animal fat, in the northeast, which when you think back to the ancient Greek necromancy, you know, these like blood sacrifices to get the dead out. And then in the southwest, you have more sacrifices, but it's more kind of like organic matter. So like drink, food, less bloody. My theory, oh yeah, and the whole like nine shapes around it, nine is often equated with death, the sort of like time it takes to get to hell, the number of steps that Thor takes before dropping down dead after he gets sprayed with poison at Ragnarok. There's, you know, Odin, he hangs on the world tree for nine nights. It's all death related, really. So I was going to say, yeah, and I think that the Yertvi grid, my sort of working theory is that the Yertvi grid is a necromantic grid. It is for calling up the dead. Well, that was my initial theory, because I always started out with one working theory and I had to, you know, change it as I went along. So for me, it was initially a necromancy only thing. And I saw similarities in the grid and the description of the necromantic grid in the Faryingr saga. I don't remember which chapter it is, but there is one of the sagas, and a guy called Thranda, he actually sets up a grid inside a house because they're trying to figure out how a guy died. And they describe it as being like a square, like four hurdles in a square with nine enclosures going out in all directions from the square. And when you look at the grid, that's what you get. I can't say it's the same design, but I think it is. Yeah, that's my thing. So that's a Yertvi grid. We don't know how they worked with it. And that's what I've been trying to figure out. Not how they did it, but a way to work with it.
Yeah. Without going into too much detail or giving away too much of your secrets about this grid and what you've uncovered, I'm curious to hear how you are working with it.
Ooh.
What things you have, and of course, what you are willing to share, but things that you have uncovered from working with this grid.
Okay, so it doesn't work anything like I thought it did when I first set out.
That tracks.
This is where the fuck-ups and the gnosis come in. So it doesn't work anything like how I thought it would. When I first started working with it, I thought it would be more like whenever I've done doorpost work to call up the dead. You know, I've been doing Samhain rituals at an ADF protogrove in Gettysburg for a few years, and we were getting some really good results from them. You know, the last one we did, we actually had a full-on apparition. We had a distinct temperature drop. People felt that they saw a line of people, like sort of shadows in the trees, sort of like just beyond the sort of ritual area. And that all went once we finished the ritual. So, you know, we started getting some really good results, and there's a definite sort of stages of progression in that kind of a ritual, that kind of necromantic ritual. And I thought it was going to be similar to that, working with a grid. But the first time I worked with a grid, and this was, it was me and two friends. We went up a mountain in West Virginia to go do it because I wasn't going to do it at home when I didn't know what was going to happen with my kid and my husband at home. You know, that's just no way.
So you decided to go to one of the oldest mountain ranges in America to do this?
Absolutely.
Fuck it, go big or go home.
I mean, it's something I would do, so I approve of this, but yeah. I'm also curious to hear the lesson that you learned.
Well, the West Virginia choice was awesome. I actually really like West Virginia, like the vibes. They feel kind of familiar to me, which I don't know whether it's because, you know, the Appalachian mountain range was connected to the sort of like hills that I grew up on, like way back when. You know, there is a very kind of familiar vibe to me. It's familiar, but not familiar, you know, because there are obviously other human people here that are nothing like what I grew up with. So, you know, like there's enough familiarity that it wasn't daunting to go. It was more exciting than daunting. And my friends, they initially were like, yeah, let's do it. And then the more we talked about what was going to happen, they're like, you know, I'm not feeling comfortable with this. Like, we don't really know what's going to happen. I was like, that's cool. And so they ended up being observers for that first experiment, which also has a value. You know, so I was like, actually, that's also great because I can write down what I experienced and I can also get what you saw of it, which is also amazing. So that first experiment, and when I booked the cabin, I didn't know that it had this. There's like this little sort of like finger of land in the middle of two streams that I set up my grid on, which was awesome. I circumambulated the grid counterclockwise, pouring water and chanting. And then I sang a dirge to call up the dead. Well, I made offerings to hell because I figure if you're calling up the dead, it's polite to be like, hey, the person who's, you know, the person who runs the dead land, please let me have some visitors from your place. I will sing them back, I promise. And then I sang the dead. I sang to the dead. And usually when I do this, I use an adapted version of the Alike Wake dirge. I don't know if you ever heard it. It's a traditional dirge. The dating is sometimes given as the 14th century. And basically what's really cool about it is that it's supposed to be sung over the corpse, you know, the lich. And it's a dirge to sing over the corpse back when we used to have people laying out. And it describes the stages between the land of the living and the realm of the dead. And some of it is definitely not Christian cosmology. You know, this idea of a brig of dread, crossing the brig of dread, which in some lore is a piece of flax that the dead have to go across, or a single hair. That's not Christian. And there's always other stuff like crossing Winnemucca. And, you know, like if ever gave a souls and shirn, which like if you ever gave, you know, donations of trousers and shoes, you know, sit down and put them on, like basically charity in life is going to aid you on this journey. And there's a lot of sort of moralistic echoes in it that I wanted to pull out because the dead can get really nervous about stuff that I found working on the battlefield. So I wanted to make it like more chill and just like, hey, you're going through this bit. It's cool. We're good. You know? So I use this adapted version that starts in hell and sings to this world, to Middle Earth. And it didn't happen at all like I thought it was going to happen. I saw this dude who wasn't dead. He was wearing a white tunic, brown pants, blonde hair, and I'm thinking, what's he doing here? I'm in West Virginia. You know, like you're not expecting to see some like Scandinavian looking dude coming out of the, well, perhaps you're not. Looking back now, it's totally obvious because I set up a grid. But he's there just kind of like stood there like looking at me. And I often get this response from spirits when I do this stuff, like, what the hell are you doing? Like, well, what is this fuckery now? So he's just like looking at me. And I'm like, okay. And then I got a vibe. I'm thinking, shit, this isn't like the doorpost work. This feels like a burial mound. Cause at one point I got on the cloth, I started on the other side of the doorpost, and then I got on the cloth, and I'm like, wait, this is reminding me of that time I climbed inside a burial mound. Whoa. It's also reminding me of that other time when I did this thing on a burial mound. Okay, it's a burial mound vibe. All right. I don't know what I'm doing now. I'm going to have to go back to the drawing board. But yeah, that's cool. The rest of the night, I shut it all down. I had to do a quick slapdash sigil on a plastic bag, like a shopping bag, to contain the grid cloth in afterwards, because I'd done it on a drop cloth. I had to contain it because afterward, it had such a vibe of death. It dimmed the light in the cabin that we were in until I put it in the bag. You know, kind of created this slapdash sigil on the bag. I put it in the bag. It brightened visibly. Me and my friends, we eat. And then we start to notice that this empty chair, it sounds like someone's moving around on it. You know, when someone's sitting on a wooden chair and you can kind of hear the creaking? Mm-hmm. We had that. And I'm kind of looking at it and I'm thinking there's somebody there. It's not just a sound, there's somebody there. So I went and got a cup and I put some mead in it. And I was like, you're welcome to stay if you be a good guest. You know, if you don't cause any bother, you're welcome to stay, be welcome. And so I just had that cup there and, you know, this guest kind of like made themselves a little bit more known. They kind of a bit more cold. They were actually dead. They were a dead person. If I was to guess, I'd say they were male. They didn't actually show themselves to me, but that's like the vibe. But every time we talked about ghosts being assholes in our conversation, he would make the light flicker. Like, no, come on, stop being an asshole to
people. It's not enough to be a good guest. You got to be a good host too.
And then we're like, look, I'm sorry. Okay. Not all ghosts. All right. Not all dead people. All right. It's just this one and they were an asshole and you've been great. So every single time it was like this interaction. I did have to do something to stop them from coming upstairs where we were sleeping in the middle of the night. Just a little bit of black salt on the stairwell. That was enough to do it. And I was like, nah, come on. Nah, we're not doing that. Okay. Not in the bedrooms. And then the next day we left. I didn't get the feeling that the dead guy was going to stick around in the cabin anyway. I got the feeling it was like a temporary kind of dude who's going to get pulled back. So I wasn't too worried about him. But I kept seeing this like blonde guy outside. I looked outside, blonde guy. For a split second, the landscape would slip away and it would look like somewhere like Northern Europe instead of like the forests of West Virginia. It was really weird. And I didn't understand it at the time because, you know, hindsight's 20/20, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, right, always. So the next time I got the idea to mess around with the grid cloth, I was like, you know what? What if I went under the cloak on the grid cloth? Let's see what happens. So my kid went to school. My husband went to the office. It's like he's one day a week in the office. And I'm like, all right, yeah. I feel more comfortable with the grid. I think I can contain it at home. I don't think it's going to be a problem. And I went under the cloth. I went under the grid. I did the thing. I went under the grid. And the first thing I heard was someone laughing at me. Like, what are you doing? And I kind of sat up on the grid. And I kind of like saw in my mind's eye the same blonde guy. I'm like, oh, wait, it's you again. Like, who are you? And he kind of like gave me this like Njord vibe. But then my brain starts kicking him in like Ullr. And I'm like, so are you Njord or Ullr? And he's like, who do you think? Let's just say I'm the parent of Frey and Freya and leave it at that. And he's like, why are you doing this? Why are you mixing these two things? This doesn't work. And then he gave me instructions, full-on instructions for an entire ritual. And I was like, okay. And he had such a good sense of humor. He shows up when I do grid work now. He still shows up. You know, I don't know if he's like sort of connected to the grid in some way. But he's clearly taken pity on me and my ineptitude. And he's like, I'm going to tell this human what to do. Because they're kind of poking at something and we want the humans to do this. So then I had like this, I went and did what he said. I had this most amazing experience. And I don't get too far into that because some of that is like, I can't share it. I would be upsetting some of my allies if I shared it.
Understood.
But then I told my friends who I went to West Virginia with, I was like, hey, oh my God, I found an awesome way of working with grid. Like Njord or Spirit saying that the Njord showed up and they told me what to do and I tried it out and it's wicked. And then like, hey, we want to have a go. So then we organized a session where we went and stayed overnight at my friend's house and we set up the grid in their basement. And this one, like the one I did before was like to Alfheimr, because for me, the mound is either Alfheimr or is a realm of hell. And when you open up the grid to Alfheimr, it's a very different experience to the grid to hell. They wanted to do the, like a hell grid. So we set it up. And even before we were fully set up, before we started singing the dead through, we heard footsteps moving around the outside of our space. We had a cold wind inside what was essentially a pillar fort built around a grid drawn on a Home Depot drop cloth. Yeah, we had this wind in there, like in a closed basement. It was icy cold. We had this at one point on the sheeting that we're using, because it was very clear it had to be done at night or undercover. It had to be hidden, covered over. So my camera keeps refocusing. It's really kind of distracting me here. Exhibit A. So this one part of the sheet, it was like someone had placed a mouth against it and was breathing in and out. It was just this one bit where it was like this circle going in and out, in and out, in and out. And we tried replicating it by poking at the sheeting, like, well, does that make that kind of thing? No, nothing made that. One of my friends and I saw this guy, like this dead guy, kind of like come. And the amount, doing this stuff, the amount of times you get laughed at by spirits, it's just, you've just got to get used to it. This one guy, we both kind of saw him like psychically kind of come out, sort of like with a tankard of whatever drink, and sit down on a bench and look at us like, and be drinking like, what are you idiots doing? Like, what the hell is this? There was also this other being that showed up, and we had good concordance between like two of us were seeing pretty solidly the same things. The other person, she wasn't getting in as deep. So she was kind of giving us all right, this is a physical effects I'm seeing sort of piece of a picture. And it was a really neat experiment. And they want to do it again. And I'm just like, I'm at a point now where, because I am not messing around with creating a pillar fort with the grid, I've got a pop-up tent. You know those beach tents? I got one of those like 3, 2, 1 necromancy go pop-up beach tents things. And
on symbols on the canvas. Well,
I drew it on the base of it, and it's just like, that's my UTV grid tent now.
Yeah.
It's just like, padunk. And it's so
good. I really kind of like the idea of a pillow fort to hell, though.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like a bit of a structural nightmare when you have a cat.
That's fair. That's very fair.
Rules.
While you were talking about it, my brain did the wonderful, like, wandering curiosity thing that it does when I'm thinking about things that are very interesting. We know that burial mounds in the Norse tradition is the kind of gateway to the dead. It's basically like you go there to talk to them. And you know, we have numerous stories of deities that went through the burial mound in order to get to these otherworldly places.
Mm-hmm.
And that thought took me to another tradition where I was taught in briefly. One of the ways that they help the dead cross over is by creating almost a funeral pyre for them. But the fire is set up for them, for the spirits to physically pass through their spirits to be cleansed and to finally move on and let go. And then that led me to, what if the grid is a maze for the dead that they have to traverse through and do whatever they need to do in order to actually cross through the burial mound to enter that realm of death?
For me, the burial mounds, to me, when I get inside them, like actual burial mounds, the observation I've had of being inside one, there is a, you know, you can spend a whole bunch of time drumming, calling to the dead, but there'll come a point, you know, and that point things can get weird, you know, you can experience things, but it's like the equivalent, and Serent will know this because he was in the class. It's like the equivalent of when you go to another country's embassy here in the United States, right? You've still got that safety net. If something happens at the embassy, you know, you're not in danger like you would be if you were in the country. But there comes a point in a mound when you're doing like this kind of like calling to the dead in a burial mound, when there's a shift and things swap over and then you're on their turf. Now, as to like how that might relate to the grid, at least in my, like my working theory right now, because this is all working theories for me. You know, it's working theories, and I test them all out, and which ones work out the best and get me the best results, the ones I kind of accept until something better comes along, or until some deity comes and tells me, no, no, it's this way. And it's like, oh yeah, bro. Yeah, totally. Of course I don't call them bro. That's just silly.
I do sometimes, so you're fine.
I try not to. There are certain lines that my lot are very clear about. So, yeah, I kind of feel like the grid, it's like a map. It's like cosmology. And that map can either lead you to hell, that nine paces, or it can lead you to, like, Alfheimr. You know, if you think about the sort of overlap between fairies and the dead, and how a lot of burial mounds were also fairy mounds. And also with elves too, you go forward in time to 17th century Scotland, Isabel Gowdie. She talks about going to the elfers' houses, like the mounds, and, you know, the devil giving her shot, well, the elf boys making the shot that the devil, quote unquote, shaped to his own hand, and they gave him to witches to shoot. That's remarkably close to, minus the devil bit, that's remarkably close to what the sort of like pattern you see in the Laknunga charm with Fastitcher. You know, you have the Hagtassin or witches who are, you know, they're shooting the sort of like shot that the smithas or the smiths have given them, who Alaric Hall in elves in Anglo-Saxon England. Yes. Elves in Anglo-Saxon England, he argues that the smithas are quite clearly the elfa, the elves. When you, and again, mounds were called Elfheim, the queen of Elfheim. That literally means that's Alfheimr. It's the same thing, the Scots word for it. So, you know, there's this overlap there. And in later years, there are all these stories about people seeing the dead, their ancestors, with the fairies in Faerie, or with the elves in Elfheim. The realms have never really been wholly separate, I don't think. I think you can kind of go in with an intention of going to one place or the other with the grid. You know, what I see at Wayland Smithy, for example, sometimes you go to Alfheimr and you're Wayland's turf, other times you go to hell and you're dealing with that dickhead in there. So that's I'm sorry, did that actually answer your question? I just rambled.
Yeah, I actually appreciate the ramble for both in terms of I enjoy listening to this, and also in terms of my partner and I are experimenting with the grid as well. And one of the things that we are getting, I'm basically getting marching orders that I have to make the fucking thing tonight. So one of the things that I know we talked about in the experiential portion of your class was we talked about our work with the Dvergar.
Mm.
And we are very damn near certain at this point that this thing, I think you're on the money with it being a map. Mm-hmm. You know, with the nine steps, the nine worlds of Helheim, the nine in general for Yggdrasil. Mm. I also think it's a kind of a stopgap. Mm. The technology serves as almost like a Hellgrinder.
Mm.
Like, for those who are listening and don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, it's a Hellgate. And it serves as a kind of a stopgap so that instead of going there and journeying in spirit with your mm. hammer on the line, your second skin, you actually have something in between you and the next world as a kind of a... It's kind of like the computer in this case. So we're talking through the medium of podcasting equipment. And I think the Gotavi grid kind of serves that purpose.
I think if you're there long enough, you will get that shift.
I agree. Like,
and you will end up in the, you know, one of the things that happened in the experiment that I did with my friends when they joined in as well was we got to a point where, okay, I feel like the shift is happening. Do you guys feel that? There was a very definite shift and then things started to ramp up more. And there was a sense that, okay, we're no longer in Kansas anymore or even Maryland or Virginia. So, you know, I think that it can be that kind of threshold up to a point, but there is a tipping point where you can go over and you do lose that that separation.
So my partner had to go grab that. Oh, go ahead.
Just a second, Sarah. When I was listening to you a second ago, I had to... I was amused because I'm looking at the notes that I'm taking on my marker board here as we go through the episode. Episode 109. Just saying.
Yeah.
Just nine in it. I love it. One of the things that I've been experimenting with as well, and this was because of a trance journey I did. Because ever since I've done the Yertvi grid work, the deities that we call the Vanir have been like, oh, yes, yes, yes. Let's do more stuff with you, human. So they've been kind of like chipping in and giving me more stuff to do. And they showed me the grid in a smaller form. And so me being a stitcher, I embroidered a grid. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to sit under my blanket, my cloak thing that I use with my mind work, and I'm going to trance with it and see what happens. And I got a similar depth of trance doing that. Not the same kind of like your traveling between worlds thing, but a similar depth of trance with that as I did in the actual grid itself. It wasn't... Again, it the detail you get when you're trancing in a grid is a lot stronger, a lot clearer. I can see Seraph getting really excited over here. I want to know what he's going to say. Okay.
Sorry. There's things that are clicking really, really hard.
Oh.
I was shown a miniature version of this grid.
Almost like a gaming board, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it could be either this big, like about a 4x4 square. It could be a 1x1 if you need to keep it in a wallet.
Mm.
The point of the thing is to serve as that doorway or opening or floorboard and map. Because if the part of the reason that it's taken me so damn long to get the grid done is because in my initial assessment, I'm like, oh, this has to be huge. It's got to be floor length.
Mm.
They're like, yeah, why don't you just back that shit up, dude?
Mm.
Well, you know what I immediately started thinking of when you guys were talking about the smaller ones is my grandmother used to make them all the time, and she'd set us up as kids for projects. You get those little 4x4 or 3x3 cross stitch squares that you could needlepoint, and you could actually make a grid out of those and hinge them together at the edges and have a little folding version. You could
so
take
that's
with you.
I have a folding version. I use the cross stitch cloth, the Ida stuff. And I kept getting this, like, it's got to be blues and purples. These are like the colors. And I got this like blues kind of, this bluish kind of like Ida. It wasn't cross stitch because it was just like me stitching lines. because if they actually did it as like little crosses, it'd be huge. And now it's foldable. I put a backing on it. It goes in my little sort of like ritual wallet. I have a makeup bag that I keep my main ritual tools in. So like my ritual cords that I have, my soul lore work, the different cords I have pertain to sort of like my different dedications to deities, the veil I wear when I'm doing ritual work as well, and my bells, because I use bells in ritual. And I also have these, another thing that kind of was made clear to me is like, after you work with this, you need to leave an offering of wine, like red wine, almost like blood. And so I wanted to get these little containers that were easy to travel. Because again, this focus was on like mobility, having this mobile form of magic, you know, so being able to fold it up, being able to like kind of travel with it as needed. And so I found these little sort of like ramekin bowls, like side dish bowls. It was like, they can't be plastic. They can't be damaging the environment, but they also couldn't be pottery because they'd get broken. And I found this, it's a form of plastic made out of wheatgrass or wheat straw. And if you plant it in the ground, it will fully degrade. And that was like, okay, we accept that. So and it's blue. I basically have this little sort of a year to the grid travel ritual thing. I've been told that if it's during the day, it needs to be covered because the whole hidden underground kind of thing again. At night, you don't need to do that so much. And yeah, it works really well. So I'm really excited that you've also had the, because you're not the only other person who said that to me as well. I have a friend, Daniela Simina. She's also got a book. She's got a book that came out. She grew up with a grandmother who was a fairy seer in Romania. And so she grew up with that tradition. I wrote an endorsement for a book of hers that's coming out either later this year or next year, Free Moon Books, called Walking the Fairy Path. It took me like 6 months to memorize the title of my own book. So please don't take this as like me, you know, I don't remember titles.
Send her our way and we'll be glad to interview.
Oh my God, you should. She's awesome.
Please.
Yes. She's an absolutely wonderful person. Really awesome stories. Really, really cool person. She and I get a lot of very similar results. And we often sort of like do experiments like at the same time and compare notes. And I made her one of those mobile grids, one of the sort of stitched ones, and sent it to her in the mail. And so she's been working with that as well and telling me what she gets from it. So because she'd also seen the game board size one, the smaller one, in a trance. So it's awesome that you saw one too. It's just really neat. And this isn't something we have in the sources, but this is a thing about magical reconstruction, right? You start out with what's in the sources and what's archaeologically found. And we can't ever do what they did exactly the same way back when. What we're trying to do is we're trying to mine this back down to the same seam. You know, we're not going to do it the same mine. We're not going to do it the same way. But as long as we can get to the same seam and interact with the same beings, then I think we're on the right track. But once you start to interact with those beings, you have to be prepared to innovate. And, you know, it has to be a living process. It's got to be a two-way street. So it's not just pure reconstruction. And that's why I don't think it can ever be just pure reconstruction. It has to be a back and forth between you and the holy powers. And once you start getting that, then you start getting these really cool sort of like, hey, you can make smaller versions to travel around with. Sorry, I'm really excited right now. This is, please, Sarah, tell me how it all goes.
Oh, trust, I will. And it's this kind of collaboration that I appreciate so much, both about your work in general and the circles that we both travel in. Especially because
so excited.
It really is. I really dig this because there's anchors into other work that I'm doing that are starting to become a little more apparent to me. I've been doing save work since roughly I became a heathen.
Yeah.
In 06-ish. Mm. And rune work as well. And there's, as I go through looking at the grid, looking at I'm I just finished reading volume one of the Heathen Soul Lore book. I'm working through the second volume. There's things that are stacking up, things that are coming together in a way that are clearly directed, but also there's this freedom of experimentation that I really appreciate about it all.
Yeah.
That we're not hidebound.
Yeah.
That the lore is a source of inspiration and a map.
And wisdom as well.
Right.
Yeah. People really, the sort of Heathen Revival has really leaned into this kind of rugged individualist Viking sort of ideal. And that's not what it is. You know, I don't think it is. This is one of the reasons why I really appreciate the work of Winifred Rose, who does the Heathen Soul Lore stuff. By the way, that working through the Heathen Soul Lore material was literally life-changing for me, and in a very high, very holy, whole-making kind of way. And I hope it's the same for you, because it is amazing.
It has so far provided me words to describe things.
Wonderful.
There are going to be some points where I'm not going to jive with like certain descriptions, because my experiences to this point have been X or Y. But I actually think that part of the beauty of experimentation is going, this is where my experiences line up. This is where it doesn't. Here's where I agree with this. Here's where my understanding of things differ. And even in that, there is a lot of value. And the work that she has put into these books is just amazing. I wish I'd had these. These are published in 22. For those of our listeners who don't know, these literally just became available in the last year, and her work is just fucking awesome.
It's also available for free online.
Yep.
At heathensoullore.net. She, for Winifred, it's always been very important to her that it's available for everyone, regardless of like cost. So she wanted to have it for free, and then also for sale for people who wanted to have it physical copy. So, you know, Winifred's such an awesome, solid person. She's just fantastic. And she's also very open to you saying like, okay, so I don't quite jive with this idea of it. This is how I've experienced my soul. And she'll be like, well, you know what? Maybe that's how you experience your soul. And that's totally how you're going to experience them. You have to listen to your souls, not me.
And that's one of the things I love about her book, and also about your own writing, is that your mileage may vary. For instance, I tried doing the spinning thing for the longest fucking time. I don't have a head for it. My wife is a spinner, and I'm like in awe. But what I can do is I can do basic chain stitch. What I can do is I do leather work.
Yeah.
So for me, one of the downloads I got while we were talking about it, the Gotabi grid's going to, the small one is going to be done on a sheet of leather.
And that'd be amazing.
I'm going to burn it.
Yes.
But these differences bring out our own flavors of experiences of magic, of heathenry, of Sather, of the grid itself. The stuff that we've experienced over the years here as a podcast, and just the mound work workshop that I did with you, has provided a lot of links into my own practice. And what I really appreciate is that it's not just a, hey, I'm going to tell you this is how it is. It's a back and forth conversation between you, us, as a community, the holy powers, you know, the Ginregen, and everybody that we're in community with, because like this shit touches everybody at some point.
That's a
huge thing that I appreciate about your writing and Rose's, is that you're not the rugged individualism shit doesn't work, because the essence of heathen soul lore itself and spirit work in general is you're not alone.
Yeah, we're all interconnected. We're all part of this incredible tapestry of life, you know. You also see this in, I also want to mention Maria Kvilhaug's work. She's
awesome.
Her work is so valuable. So, so valuable. She is basically taking, like a lot of people talk smack about Snorri Sturluson. He wrote the Prose Edda, and the second book of that, Skaldskaparmál, it's basically a guide for how to read Old Norse poetry and how to understand it. because the Kennings, there's different different sort of like animals are associated with different things, like wolves associated with greed, different other ones associated with death. You know, he basically wrote it because those young kids in his day could no longer understand the poems of their time. And, you know, he wanted to make it so that people didn't lose the ability to write poetry. It was a huge part of Icelandic culture at that point, and he wanted to preserve it. And what Maria's done, and it's one of these things where, like, sometimes genius is like the most obvious thing ever, but you have to be a genius to see it. Maria is just taking the guidebook that Snorri gave us and applying it to the sources, and then coming back with, you know, okay, so this is what I think this is actually talking about. So probably the best example is, well, I'll go with most well-known example. So Ragnarok, right? We've all heard big boss battle between the gods and the Jotnar, the baddies, whatever you want to call them. Not that I think that, you know, all Jotnar are baddies or anything. I don't at all. But you've got this boss battle Ragnarok. You have Odin, who gives one of the souls to Askan Embla. You know, he gives the breath soul, the Und. And there's kind of a debate as to whether he's also Hernia and Lothar as well. It's possibly like a Jamie Madrox situation with Odin at times, you know? So maybe he's all of them. But either way, you have a god that gives a soul-giving god. And he's killed by Fenrir, who is, you know, wolf symbolizing greed. Soul giver, killed by greed. You know, what's that say? What kind of lesson is that? You know, that's a really deep thing, isn't it? And especially when you then start to think about, okay, well, what turned Fenrir into an enemy? You know, he was isolated. He was basically kept on island, left alone, tortured over fear of a prophecy that may not have happened. You know, they read some prophecy in an old book, and then, you know, oh crap, this wolf dude is getting a bit big, he's scaring us. You know, bad things going to happen. So then that's like, you have to be careful with prophecies. You have to, you know. So anyway, you know, they read this prophecy in his book, and looking at this wolf, it's getting a bit big, this wolf. What do? We've got to make sure he can't do anything. And then, to my mind, they go and do all the things that turn the wolf into an enemy that then creates a problem down the line anyway. And when you think about what creates greed in humans, it's usually scarcity. It's usually isolation. It's usually fear. So again, you've got like a really useful lesson there. And think about like Thor with Jormungandr. Jormungandr, I can't figure out why Thor decides, you know, F that snake. Can you? Like, he's just there existing. And then Thor's like, I'm going to pick this cat up. And he couldn't pick the cat up. And but it was really Jormungandr. And Utgard Loki, he's like, oh my God, we were so scared. You actually almost picked him up because, like, would have torn all the, I don't remember how it says, but basically, like, the boundaries of reality asunder or something. Mm-hmm. And so Thor kind of gets his feud going on. Like, for whatever reason, the Midgard serpent is on his shit list. And that right there is kind of like showing, well, you know, hatred, rage, what's the point of that? You know, it destroys things. It will destroy community. Once he kills Jormungandr, that's when everything breaks loose. Yep. Because Jormungandr is like,
literally holding the waters back. Yeah.
Well, not just the waters. Like, there's this sense of like barrier there, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and, when you look at the word gander as well, gander, spirits, wand, magic, also penis. and then, yeah, I'm not going to go on about that anymore. Because I could go off on one about, before you know it, into elves and Ergi, and that's always sketchy territory. So
yeah, this show has never done a tangent before, don't worry.
Nope, not at all.
Yeah, no, you really don't want me to start banging on about that.
I think that I take your point, though, that one of the beautiful things about plumbing the depths of our myths for ideas and understanding is that they are maps in multiple ways. They're not just maps in terms of, well, this is how we can understand the orientation of the world. It's also our place in things. It's also what is right relationship. It is also... So my personal theory about Ragnarok is that it's cyclical, and we have input on whether or not it goes off like it did the last time. And I think part of why you're seeing a rise in Fenris worship, besides the fact that it's a scary wolf god and it's metal and shit, is because we are watching what happens when we cage ourselves, when we take other people's prophecies, if you will, of what should be, of what is, and we are forced to swallow that poison. I think one of the things that people forget is the river that comes out of Fenris's mouth is literally named Hope.
That's interesting. I never thought about it that way, Sarah. Is that saying that sometimes our wilder side is sometimes too shackled by laws, and it causes us to lose hope?
I think it's worth pointing out that the being who sacrifices his hand, one of the first attestations that Tyr has is the good peacekeeper. Another is that it's specifically his oathing hand that's bitten off. And when you are willing to put yourself out there for community, you can only keep injustices at bay with that kind of sacrifice, which I believe was a noble one on Tyr's point. I think it was a noble sacrifice that he had to make in the moment, because I think it was either that or they were going to just straight up kill him.
Yeah.
So he took the lesser of two evils, but eventually you have to pay that shield.
Well, and we got to remember that Tyr was one of Fenris's most trusted beings too. Tyr was really the only one that was capable of trapping him.
The only one who would feed him as well.
Yeah.
Because the others were too scared to go near him to feed him. I think another lesson here as well is when you look at the different sort of theta names that they apply to Fenrir, you know, stuff like I don't remember the actual names, but one of them's kind of like binding down, you know, sort of like, I can't remember now. My brain is kind of going out to lunch. Pardon?
Gripnir.
I'm trying to remember the English translation of that.
Give me 5 seconds.
Okay. But basically, when you look at them, you can kind of see them as different ways of dealing with your emotions that you don't like. You know, like you can either sort of like stifle them, you can either try to hide them under religion, or you can either kind of try to pretend they don't exist and hide them away somewhere, which is what they essentially did with Fenrir. But that's always going to come out. So it's like you have to sort of face it. You have to learn to live with it and not isolate it and not let it become a greed wolf.
So what's really interesting is the term Gleipnir is a term that means open one. It's as thin as a silk ribbon and stronger than iron. And it was forged by Dvergar. So the sound of a cat's footfall, the beard of a woman, the roots of mountains, the sinews of the bear, breath of the fish and spittle of the birds were the components put into it.
So all really easy ingredients then. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I really think it's...
I do like that though, that... I'm sorry, Caitlin, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's really cathartic to think about the fact that Fenris is kind of the embodiment of all of the, all of humanity's like negative or bad emotions. And for our listeners, I was doing air quotes because I don't think any emotions are negative or bad. They're useful if used properly, but the river that flows forth from its mouth is literally hope. There's an interesting lesson in that, because in order to unfetter those emotions, in order to break those chains, in order for Fenris to be released, is that you have to engage with him. You have to embrace those emotions. You have to look at them and say, okay, this is painful, this is really hard, but that is where your hope comes from, is in those dark places.
Now right? Think about who actually kills greed at Ragnarok. Vithar, the wide ruler, known as the silent god. You know, that's kind of like, that always makes me, and this is totally just like gnosis, that always makes me think of like, you know, someone who has spent a lot of time just sort of sitting down, reckoning with themselves, like they just, and I don't know, to me that, like Sarah said, you can read myths on a number of different levels. No, I don't think any interpretation is wrong per se, unless you're just straight up making shit up. You know, like, you know, well, Fenrir is actually a unicorn and he's the Morrigan's favorite pony. You know, that's clearly bullshit. But you, there's different ways of understanding myths. There's different types of truth. You know, you can read them. Right. You can read them as being like, you know, some myths like Gullveig being burned in the Hall of Har. You can read that as being, you know, well, we know from archaeological finds that you had the this wardenization in the migration period. You know, you started to see like these sort of finds. They went from being, you know, very sort of like goddessy, boggy, marshy type finds, and you start to see spears and the spear god. You start to see the rise of the warband cultus, which is very Michael Enright. Yeah, so that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is, you know, the just a sort of mythological war between the Aesir and Vanir, and the Vanir having this like power of rebirth. Another way of looking at it is, well, Gullveig, golden brew, just being refined, like possibly pertaining to a sacred drink. You know, there's all these different possible interpretations. A sacred drink of immortality, perhaps it, you know, relates to Soma or Homa. You know, I've read so many different theories about this story. And this is the thing about myths. You know, they invite us to think about things on different levels.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of benefit to kind of like having those thought experiments. And you don't, you can't take it as dogma. You know, when we start taking it as dogma, then we're being idiots. But like, there are deeper truths there, but they're not always what's on the surface. And there's multiple layers. We're actually very smart in that way. So,
I agree with that. I mean, just from our conversation just now, you and Sarenth were taking the conversation at a more personal level about emotions, where I was taking in that same story and thinking it more about cultural, about mm-hmm. when I look at the state of the world right now, I think that sometimes the laws have to sacrifice themselves mm-hmm. to feed the wolf, to feed the people, essentially.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you find a lot with, and this is something that's not, it's only really been like explored more recently in modern heathenry. You know, it was, I mean, I've been a heathen since the 90s. I've seen all the kind of rah-rah Viking stuff you could ever not want to see in your life. This is a more recent thing, I'd say within the past 5 or so years. Although Maria's work has been out for longer, she just got absolutely screwed on her first book contract. And so, you know, it's only really, as she's been getting her stuff republished and getting possession of her own stuff again, that it's getting more widely disseminated, which is wonderful. And Winifred's stuff is coming out as well more. We've got this awesome, awesome atmosphere where more people are experimenting. And I don't know, I kind of feel like heathenry is in a growth and growing. There's parts of heathenry that are growing in a much more wise and mindful way and cleaving to interconnectedness and a more animistic perspective. And I just find it really beautiful. Yeah.
Something that Lauren Crowe pointed out when we had her on was Ben Wagoner has been talking about how we are now firmly out of the stage of where we need to cite chapter and verse. We are firmly into the needing lab work in heathenry stage. And I could not agree with him more.
That is such a good way of putting it. The need in the lab work. That is an amazing way to put it.
When I first heard that, I thought of the Mythbusters thing. The difference between science and screwing around is writing shit down. That's a really fun thing that I am appreciating, both in terms of the social media apparatus that we have out there right now, the blogs and everything else, that we can actually share notes in real time if we want to.
Yeah. I think that Hemer is kind of at a crossroads right now. And we have a choice. We can either keep just kind of doing the same old bullshit you know, that we've been doing for the past 30 years or 40 years, 50 years, whatever. Or we can grow. That's like the challenge. I kind of feel like we're sort of beginning to make that transition to an actual living religion in our mindset, as opposed to reenacting and just sort of, you know, it's
awesome. I think that's humanity as a whole at this point. We can either keep doing the same bullshit that we've been doing for the last God knows how long now at this point, or we can go through the painful process of change and alteration and find a new course, one that is more viable and more comfortable and more promising for all people instead of for just some.
So, question for you guys. I know that you guys like asking me questions, but I've got a question for you guys. If you were to pick a point, if you were to pick a point in history when the rot, when things start to go wrong, where would you place it?
The rot of what particular?
Kind of like when things start to go wrong, you know, when, you know, largely humans in Europe, because let's face it, we fucked up most of the world. When we started to kind of change toward a more exploitative ideology, I guess, because that's what I see as the rot here, you know, like the people as things kind of.
I don't know. I don't think there is a place to pinpoint in our known history of when the rot began or when it got worse. I think it's something that is always there. And I think it's something we as people need to be mindful of, you know?
Yeah.
Because it is, I don't want to say it like this, but my brain's not fucking working right now. Rot is a part of nature.
Yeah, that wasn't a good term on my part. I was just trying to come up with a word. I didn't actually rot.
But I understand what you're saying, but I think there are cycles. You know, we have methodologies of going through and experimenting with certain things. It's just when we get stuck on certain processes that benefit, you know, a handful over the majority is when the rot is, or the tumor or the growth or the absurdity that is the human experience gets out of hand and out of control. It is when we need to rebalance. And there have been many rebalancing points throughout history, known and unknown, I'm sure, of where there will come a time, because it's necessary, that the tables will turn, but it's up to us to make sure that it doesn't just flip sides.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of torn. Emily in the chat makes a good point about wrong with which civilization, because then ideas of race get involved in that sort of thing. And especially like, you know,
And Emily's absolutely right. Europe was a of race as a concept is absolutely, yeah. That's definitely one of those points, isn't it?
Well, and even like things weren't always equal. Like when one area was in rot stage or downfall stage, then another area and another part of the world might have been in its height, yeah, or in its ascension. So I kind of think that, like we were talking about with mistakes, when we're talking about with before the show, when we talked, you know, briefly about how, you know, like we as hosts, our points of view have changed over time. I think really I can only look at humanity and hope for the future. And at some point in the future, we're going to be able to look back and go, wow, look how far we've come. Because I don't think there is necessarily rot. There's mistakes for sure.
Yeah.
There's problems. There's stuff that we need to correct. At the same time, we wouldn't be where we are in other areas if we hadn't made those mistakes. So I think for me, it gets back into that whole paradigm of light and heavy versus good and evil, growth versus rot sort of thing. I mean, theoretically, it's the swamp of humanity. We can't have growth without some of the rot. You know,
I think rot really was a bad idea.
Like, no, I mean, I appreciate where you're coming from. Yeah, but okay, I mean, there's... So-
Let me tell you where I actually got this like musing from. Okay. So, I find myself thinking a lot about Augustine and the effect of the Augustinian worldview on Europe. You know, it went from an animistic worldview to this worldview in which, you know, humans are separate from nature and only humans have souls. And, you know, to me, that's one of those kind of points where, okay, that's when the bad things start to happen, because then I think some people have always seen other human people as resources. You know, some people, I think all human societies have always had people within them that have been, you know, not great examples of like the culture, you know, but, I kind of feel like when something like that becomes the norm on institutional and religious level, then that leads to major problems. But then when you read like Tyson Yunker Porter's book, Sand Talk, he talks about the emu deception, you know, and there's this point where he's like musing, you know, when did this start? When did the emu deception start to get out of control? And he goes back to like, and he talks about ancient Sumeria, you know, and it's just one of those things that I've tried, like, I kind of find myself thinking about, like, you know, the emu deception is this narcissistic thing. Like the first one, one person starts thinking about themselves as being more important than other people, you know, and things start to go to balance in that way. So I guess that's where I was going with it. Rot really wasn't a good term for where I was going with it, but I was looking for a noun. Does that make more sense now?
I still struggle to answer that to a certain degree, because
it's a hard one, isn't it?
Well, I mean, like, what are we talking about when we started walking upright? Because there's obviously evidence of warfare between humans and Neanderthals, but there's also examples of them interbreeding. So where do we want to throw that in there? You know, I mean, there's.
Yeah, it's a really kind of like, it's really interesting thing to think about, I think.
I mean, to a degree, it's almost back to that wolf in chains argument. Is the wolf good or evil? It was just different, and it was in chains. So,
I thought you said genes then for a moment. I thought we're going back to werewolves before the show.
Werewolves in tight Levi's. I thought we're going back to
the werewolf erotica before the show.
Everyone knows where the werewolves wear the tight Levi's. Are vampires more carpenter pants, or what are we talking? No,
I'm pretty sure. Crushed I'm velvet. Pretty sure they wear Wranglers.
Crushed velvet, yeah. Leather pants, because I don't sweat.
No, leather pants are strictly vampires.
Yeah, that's what I mean, Ramps. They're totally, yeah.
But yeah, I get where you're coming from, but it's a difficult one to answer, because there's so much stuff interwoven in human history. There's so much cause and effect that it's very hard to pinpoint like a first domino.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, I think I'm sorry, Saren.
Go ahead.
Drop this before I lose it. Humans or the creatures known as humans have existed on this planet for a very long time. I'm very sorry, Christians and et cetera, who believe otherwise, but you're wrong. But we are still a relatively young species when it comes to consciousness and understanding our consciousness and our relationship with others. And we did kind of screw ourselves by moving away from the animistic view, but I think in a way it was necessary for the next evolution of the human consciousness, the next understanding that we are breaking into or very close to breaking into now. But
see,
we have,
I don't think, it was, you know, like, I don't know. I
think that plays a little too much into the evolution of religion for my taste. But I get kind of where you're coming from in that we have to go through certain periods of decline, rising, decline, rising, the cycle of developing our understanding of who and what we are is a constant. And I think it's really like something I'm listening to right now through Esoterica is the occult. Something to do with the foundations of occultism in Stoicism and how Platonism and Stoicism have almost entirely different ideas of how human beings relate to the world. Which in the one hand is basically one of the best damn things since sliced bread. And then the other thing is that we're not that terribly remarkable. Like we more of a, we used to be. And then as time went on, we kind of got away from deep relationships with the gods. One of the things that's talked about is like onomatopoeic language, going away from that into much more layered meanings instead of like straight up language represents what you're saying, into the deepening layers of language, and how going away from that direct relationship has introduced problems. I think to directly answer your question, I think this is a cyclical thing. I think that the real breakdown we're seeing is a similar one to Ymir the Screamer getting killed by Othin and his brothers for being basically a not very nice slash abusive god, and forming the new worlds out of his corpse with it. I think it's the same cycle that you see reflected in Ragnarok. It's what really kicks off both Ymir's death and the Ragnarok cycle is the same thing. It's the sundering of proper relationships. So I think that this is a constant, because even our myths with which we are orienting our understanding of the cosmos around echo these things. I don't think there's any one particular point in time where it's like, that's it. That's the point. I think that it's a
recurring
theme.
That's the point. We know not what not to mess up now. Because that's why I think about it. I'm always thinking like, if we can kind of pinpoint that, maybe we can like think about what we can work on, you know? That's just the way my brain works.
And I think that's a valid thing to look for. I think the common factor for me is breakdown of relationship. The common factor is when the oppressive forms of life, in the case of Ymir, or in the case of Ragnarok, when the cycle becomes too bogged down in bullshit, because what actually releases the Hathiod skull and allows them to catch the sun and the moon is being fed murderers and thieves. So oathbreakers.
Yeah.
So when they get so fat and energized from these
oathbreakers, the axe age,
I think that actually provides us a clue.
Yeah.
Because what are they being fed? Lies, liars, murderers, people who sunder relationships. I think it is a personal and a societal.
Yeah.
If you're doing the things that help your community is going to be able to thrive in different directions. If you're being the oath breaker, you're hurting Haminya. You're hurting the very fabric of society at some level.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the institutional rot now because the United States was founded on lies.
That's weird, isn't it? That's weird coming out.
I'm going to favor a little bit the category of we're not that remarkable in the sense that we've seen in so many other animal populations when a certain type of animal becomes dominant in its ecosystem, it leads to starvation and problems and entire disruptions. The only place we're unique is in the width and breadth of our ecosystem.
And the degree to which we have manipulated our world to make it easier for us to survive. Yeah.
I mean, I would say that although our technology and our philosophy and our religion is really advanced in some ways, a lot of the problems boil down to some of the same biological urges that other species encounter.
Yeah, like I think about things cyclically as well. And it for me, it's more kind of like this idea of a wolf age and an apple age, which for me, the apple age is totally based in gnosis. The apple age, it's not like utopian. It's just like times when the threats aren't so existential as in the wolf age. And I think that the wolf age makes everyone wolves, but you pick what kind of a wolf you're going to let it make you be. Is it going to be a greed wolf, or is it going to be the kind of wolf that looks after their family members and their like communities and the kind of wolf that they sort of like release into Yellowstone and regenerate the ecosystem there? You know, so I think there's cycles and there's cycles, and, you know, in an average cycle, that rot is the foundation of a renewal. If you look at like rotting bodies of insects, they're all food for plants. But yeah, you know, it's, yeah.
I can agree with that, definitely. I mean, I think it is part of the cycle. It's just that, if from my purview, the cycle is one we've seen happen in other species, and we just have to go through our own versions of it, as we've gone through it before.
Unfortunately, we take a lot of other species with us.
Unfortunately, this is true.
Yeah. We're not like the other species in that way.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. No. And if we're not careful, there'll be another species to try again after us.
Spiders. Giant intelligent spiders that make cat noises. That's my vote. Or octopi.
Oh, I like that. I'll read a book about that. That sounds good. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. It has been a really great conversation. We really appreciate having you on. This is I think we could have you back sometime and go down this whole rabbit hole of the end part of the show again. This could be something we could really dive into.
It is a massive rabbit hole. It's also just my brain going off on one, so.
I appreciate it.
Maybe we should invite her on for one of our next specific topics episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. One of these days we should have just a big round table too, where two or three guests and just have a big, huge, here's the topic.
We'll sit back and direct the cats, but talk amongst yourselves.
You should definitely also have Daniela Semina on, and also Morgan Daimler, if you haven't already.
On the list.
Very cool people.
Would be awesome to have on as well.
Yes.
Agreed.
Yes.
I really appreciate all the time that you spent with us here tonight. I'd love to pick your brain more about Sather when we get a chance.
Thank you for having me and emailing me at any point with your magical experimentation.
Will do.
Because I just want to know. I love it.
Get stories of grids coming in the email. So
Yes. Just keep that conversation going so we can kick that can down the road collectively. You know, it's how we're going to get better. Just like sharing the information and trying things out.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners. And a reminder, if there's guests that you'd like, if there's topics you'd like to cover us to cover, you feel free to email us or contact us through social media. We thank you again, as always, for so much of your support. And with that, we'll see you next time around the fire.